It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 5 years ago, Patrick Gallagher was selected as Chancellor of the University of Pittsburgh to succeed Mark Nordenberg. At the time, Patrick Gallagher was serving as Acting Deputy Secretary of Commerce in the Obama administration. We're going to talk about the role of public universities in higher education, as well as state financial support and many other topics. Patrick Gallagher, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to be here.
So it's been nearly 5 years since you came back to where you earned that PhD. In terms of goals that maybe you stated publicly at that time or had up here in your head you didn't reveal, where are you?
Well, I feel like it's always a mixed bag. I feel great about some of the things we've accomplished, but I am always impatient to do more. So incomplete.
You've given yourself an incomplete grade. You're a tough grader.
Especially on myself, I think.
Well, we want to talk about that list a little bit more and the plans for the future, both near term and long term. But I wanted to get your insights into what's being called the largest college admissions cheating scandal. 50 people in 6 states, including actresses, business leaders, college coaches, were accused by the Justice Department of bribery and fraud to help students gain admission into elite colleges and universities. So 8 colleges and universities have been named in the federal investigation. Are you concerned that some students, some parents might be wondering about other institutions of higher education?
Well, I think that's what makes a story like this so compelling. I think people are wondering whether there's a double standard at play, the one that all of us sort of face, that where it's based on your own talents and achievements, and maybe a separate standard for those that can afford to pay for it. And I think that's why there's a sense of outrage about the story. I think that, you know, it's interesting to me that, you know, the story has a couple elements to it. One is it's fascinating how important getting a college education was to some of these parents. I mean, in some ways, there's kind of a funny side to that. That's, a great college education is something that opens doors and changes lives. And you saw how what extreme some of these parents were willing to do that for their kids. But the dark side of this, I think, is the fact that you want this to be based on the achievement of these students. Mm-hmm. And there's too much focus on these elite institutions and what they narrowly bring, too much focus on the institutional reputation of these schools. And you see what happens. It with enough money, it challenged the integrity of some of these admissions processes.
Pitt has not been named. No hints, whatever. But does this scandal at other schools, does that have you sort of reexamining your own policies and double checking to make sure that, okay, I'm confident we're doing things right, doing the correct way, but let's double check on that?
Always. I think, in any kind of situation where something is supposed to never happen, issues of impropriety, scandal, safety issues. You always use these as teachable moments. And so, yes, we immediately started looking at, do we have any of the structural problems that could have led to this kind of integrity breakdown? By and large, we think we're in pretty good shape, but there's always room for improvement. And in particular on the athletic side and some of the other areas, we'll be adding more independent oversight to make sure that we're not susceptible to this kind of thing happening.
We've heard a few presidents of the universities that have been named claim that their university is a victim. That kind of statement, what do you think? What kind of message does that send to parents and to students who are not trying to game the system? They're trying to do it the right way. They hear that the university is a victim, at least in the mind of those university leaders.
Well, candidly to me, it sounds a little bit defensive to put it that way. Mm-hmm. I think the real victims here are other students who perhaps got denied admission and couldn't get into a college that they otherwise would have gotten into because of this. Mm-hmm. I think that the institutions can feel frustrated by this, and in many cases, some of the breakdowns occurred due to systems that we depend on, things like standardized testing. We assume that that's a high integrity process and that those test scores mean what they are supposed to mean. But to argue that this was an attack on the institutions themselves, thereby making them the victim, that strikes me as a little bit of a stretch.
Do you have any insights about this seeming fixation, obsession with we must get our kids into one of these so-called elite schools? And how does that make you feel as the leader of a university that the Wall Street Journal has called one of the leading public universities in the entire Northeast? How does that make you feel?
Well, I certainly don't define elite or high quality as by how many people were willing to break the rules to get into Pitt. So, look, I think that I think parents understand that educational attainment after high school is one of the most important things that can happen to an individual. By almost every measure we know, folks who have gone on to get a college degree are much more likely to thrive, whether that's economically, in their health, and their relationships, socially. And what you see are parents who are doing everything they can to make sure that their kids get that opportunity. What I think is distorting this a little bit is the idea that only a small number of institutions that happen to have gold-plated reputations are the only place where that can happen. And that's just not true. You know, we have thousands of students coming to Pitt over the next few weeks. In fact, between now and, April, when our admissions window kind of, we'll have 5,000 students coming into Oakland. And what they're doing is not evaluating whether Pitt's reputation is as gold-plated as somebody else's. They're trying to imagine whether they can live here for the next 4 years, and this is a place where they will get that kind of educational experience that will open up doors for them. And for a lot of students, we think Pitt's going to be the right answer, and for other students, it'd be someplace else. And the reality is you can get a great education in a lot of great institutions, and I think we are focusing too much on a small number.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is University of Pittsburgh Chancellor Patrick Gallagher. In his budget plan released last month, Governor Wolf called for no increase in funding for the University of Pittsburgh and the other state-related universities. So unless something changes, Pitt would receive about the same amount as this current fiscal year. Your reaction to that?
Well, I think it's certainly understandable to me why the governor did that. I think that the state budget, at least since I've come back as chancellor, has been a story about competing priorities at the state level. And so lawmakers and the governor have to make tough decisions every year. The governor has been a steady supporter of higher ed, including the state-related university. So I don't certainly take the flat request as anything other than there were other competing priorities. As chancellor, though, I have to remind the lawmakers and the governor what the implications of those decisions are. So Pennsylvania has a rather unique model. Our flagship universities that are in the state-related system, Pitt, Penn State, Temple, and Lincoln, are subsidized by the state with an appropriation that allows Pennsylvania students to attend these great universities at a discounted price.
And that subsidy, is that about 7% or so of your total budget?
So when Pitt first became a state related, it was over 30%. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very strong subsidy, and that's why it was so affordable. Appropriations have not kept up with inflation. In fact, what's really happened, if you look back over the 30 years of history, is it's gone through periods where it's kept up, and then there's been big drops. If you take away those drop years, it would have been fine, but we've never gotten our way back out. So the funding today is about the same as it was 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so as a percentage of our budget, it's much smaller now, only accounting for about 7%. Mm-hmm.
A proposal is being floated, I believe, in the state Senate, seeking to create a commission to look at a higher education funding formula that would factor in universities' performance on key measures. What do you think of what, in essence, would be merit increases?
Well, what I'll tell you is what I told the lawmakers. I testified in front of the Senate Appropriations Committee. There's two things they need to look at. One is certainly performance. They would certainly want limited and scarce state resources to go to universities that provide the best outcomes. So typically, these kind of measures look at educational outcomes. Are students graduating? Are they being retained? Are they successful after graduation? And those are all valid measures. But there's another side of this that I cautioned lawmakers to pay attention to, and that is there's a policy question that the state has to address. So Pennsylvania actually spends a lot of money on higher education, but it spreads it across several competing programs. So we have a state-related system that funds the four flagships that I talked about. There's a state system of 14 universities and colleges that it supports. There's a community college system that it supports, and there's a student-based aid program that it supports. And those programs all have different goals. Some are designed to provide rural and very accessible educational opportunities across the state. Some are really flagship programs that are designed to attract talent and research dollars into the state and shape economic growth. I think part of the problem here is the state has not enough resources to do all the things they want to do. And so some sense of policy priority and direction is going to be very important to this as well, not just performance.
You mentioned in an earlier answer that you wanted to tell the lawmakers about the allocation, about the potential implications of what flat funding could be. You recently announced that starting this fall, the university will match dollar-for-dollar Pell Grants made to all undergrads on both main and branch campuses. So is this one way to head off or alleviate some of the impact of maybe a tuition hike? So how's that working?
Well, it's not so much about offsetting hikes, but I think as the state subsidy has gotten smaller, what you end up with is a situation where it reminds me of the airplane seats, right? There was a time when airplane seats were more expensive, but there were a lot of discounts as you got closer. And
right.
So, we knew that business travelers may have paid full price because they had no choice and had to leave the next day, but others got a discount. And then, of course, the airlines came in and said, no, we want a different pricing model where everything's discounted. What state subsidies do is allow that discounted model where if you're a Pennsylvania resident, you pay one price, it's across the board, and that's what everybody pays. As the state subsidy has dissipated and gotten much smaller, what you end up is something that looks just too high for some families. And so one of the growing areas of expense for the university is to make sure we're providing sufficient financial aid so that that loss of state subsidy doesn't create a socioeconomic problem where, we're basically segregating between those that can afford to come here and those that can't. We want every great student who qualifies to come to the University of Pittsburgh to be able to come here regardless of their family financial situation.
Well, will this proposal, quick follow-up, will it help you sort of get ahead of the curve, be right with it? Were you behind a little bit when it came to financial aid?
Behind, I think, the total amount, the way we talk about that in higher ed is what's called unmet need. And that's the difference. That's not free. There's a lot of discussion about the free education. Unmet need is the difference between the total cost of attending college and what has to be paid after the family's contribution and all the financial aid has been applied. Now, ideally, you'd like that number to be zero. That means all their, but it's really not zero. And in fact, for Pitt, the amount of financial aid that we would have to add to our budget to meet all unmet need is about $187 million a year. So the step we took on the Pell match doesn't address all of that, but it's a very important step in that direction. In fact, it's the largest restructuring of financial aid in the university's history, and it's about a 50% increase in our need-based financial aid over what it was 5 years ago.
And thousands of students will be helped by this?
Many thousands of students will be helped. I think it's about 5,000 students be supported.
So. We have just about a minute left. In your installation speech, you talked about the role of the university, quote, to be part of the full turbulence of today, to pursue the most disruptive innovations, seek to understand the most profound questions, and to serve in areas that can be most uncertain and full of risk. These are the places where the future is made, end quote. So, in a few sentences, what risky, disruptive innovations are you and the university pursuing?
Oh, lots. I always say it's kind of ironic for me to say this, since I work in a cathedral of learning, but universities are not supposed to be ivory towers. They belong in the midst of some of the most difficult challenges. And the places we're doing that are as broad as the university, in areas of medicine, in science, in our communities, doing community-based work, in matters of law and policy, on cybersecurity. In almost every realm of human endeavor, you want the university and its thought leaders, its faculty, and its students to be participating and tackling with those issues. That's where the difference is made.
Patrick Gallagher is the Chancellor of the University of Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for being here.
Enjoyed it. Great seeing you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, hemp production is set to resume in Pennsylvania after a decades-long ban. As part of our series on women in Pittsburgh history, we'll take a look back at a young woman who ran the largest hemp rope-making business in the region. Then, a Cambria County gymnast is vying an Olympic comeback at the age of 32. And trial begins today for former East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rossfeld. He's charged in the fatal shooting of unarmed teenager Antoine Rose. We'll take a look at what this case has in common with others involving black residents and white police. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
After the release of Nirvana's breakthrough album Nevermind in 1991, grunge became a household term, but the scene's seeds were sown much earlier than that. Some folks consider Malfunction among the founding fathers of grunge. Fronted by Andrew Wood, Malfunction had only recorded two songs when they broke up in 1988. That same year, however, Wood regrouped with a new band called Mother Love Bone. They were poised for success, but Wood had already been battling drug addiction for several years. He died from a heroin overdose on this day in 1990 at just 24 years old. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Industrial hemp is making a comeback in Pennsylvania after nearly a century of being illegal. The crop can be used to manufacture rope and clothing. Back when Pittsburgh was young, a woman ran the largest rope-making business in the region. As part of our series on women in Pittsburgh history, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley looks back at the life of rope magnate Mary Irwin.
On the fifth floor of his downtown Pittsburgh law office, Hugh Nevin Jr. describes the life of his great-great-great-great-grandmother, Mary Pattison. In 1784, she was living in Ireland and betrothed to a doctor. But during a St. Patrick's Day ball, a Revolutionary War hero named John Irwin walked into the room. Nevin says shortly thereafter, Mary ditched her fiancé and rushed off with Irwin.
They fell in love, and she gave up what just appeared to me an incredible step on her part, gave up everything, her family, her background, and got on a ship with him and sailed to the United States.
The young couple lived in Philadelphia briefly and then made their way to Pittsburgh, where they settled and had four children. In the 1790s, Pittsburgh was growing, and its rivers were a big part of its success. Those rivers carried boats, and those boats needed rope.
She found some acquaintances who had some knowledge about making rope and engaged them and started the rope walk in 1794.
In those days, rope was created through a rope walk, a long, narrow path where workers spun and braided strands of material to make the sturdy rope. The couple's first rope walk was along the Monongahela River. On official directories, their business was listed as John Irwin and Wife. That title was unusual, Nevin says, because wives and women in general weren't typically acknowledged in business. John was a war hero, but he was sick and weak from old battle wounds. Including his wife as a co-operator of the rope manufacturing business indicated that Mary was actually running the company.
she was also doing it in a world where women didn't do that and didn't open up businesses and run them.
Rope making was a lucrative business. The Irwins moved their rope walk to three different locations downtown and one on the north side. It would have been one of the first major industries in Pittsburgh. And because it was the biggest game in town, history buff Leon Paulum of the blog Now Then Pittsburgh says the business likely provided rope to some significant historical figures, including Commodore Oliver Perry of the Battle of Lake Erie and Meriwether Lewis of Lewis and Clark fame.
He started here. He got the boat built here. He would have needed rope for that. We presume that since Mary had the only operation making rope, that his boat used Mary's rope.
When John died, Mary and her son took over the factory. The public listing then read, Mary Irwin and Son, further evidence of her status in the business community. They had some trouble with fires due to a new waterproofing method that involved tar and open flames, but ultimately the operation prospered. By the time Mary retired, the family rope company was successful and sprawling. Madge Baker is Mary's great-great-great-great-granddaughter and says the family story is still celebrated.
It's just leave me. Both inspired and awed, and I do think in a kind of indirect way, she influenced subsequent generations of women.
Mary and John Irwin were both buried at Allegheny Cemetery. The family is still remembered in the region. The borough of Irwin was named after them, and there's a ropeway on the north side. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Crystal Bodenschatz won three national gymnastics championships as a teenager, but lost out on a chance at making the 2004 Olympic team. 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk reports that the Cambria County resident is attempting a comeback to elite gymnastics at age 32.
Bodenschatz stands tall on the balance beam before she launches into a punch front. Two of her kids are running around the gym, curious about the front flip she just performed, and jumping from mat to mat.
Okay, you gotta sit though. You have to sit. Yes.
Bodenschatz doesn't want them running under the beam in case she falls.
This is usually how I work out with my kids.
Just a handful of moms throughout the world compete in gymnastics at the elite level. Most members of the U.S. women's national team weren't even born when Bodenschatz won her first national championships as a junior in 1999. Like them, she has an eye on the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo. But it will be tough to make the team. The United States has a ton of depth.
At this point, I can't really say that I'm right with them. I'm still trying to get out, you know, my nerves and getting back into competition.
Bodenschatz grew up a self-described gym rat, always at the gym in Johnstown where her mom worked. Brenda Uselak knew her daughter could benefit from training across the state at Parkettes, a facility with a history of producing some of the country's best gymnasts.
I come home one day and said to my husband, I'm going to move to Allentown, and he absolutely thought I was crazy.
Bodenschatz progressed really quickly after the move. Her brother Donnie Uselak recalls feeling like a bodyguard the first time she won championships as fans swarmed the family after the meet.
I'm like, oh my gosh, my sister's famous, like she's gonna be an Olympian.
Bodenschatz says her coaches pushed hard to make it to the Olympics, and it caused her to leave Parkettes the year before the event, feeling burnt out. She eventually went back, only to dislocate her ankle in January 2004. She didn't even watch the games on TV later that year. Not long after, she got a concussion competing for Penn State. She moved back home to coach at her family's gym, Uselak Gymnastics. That's where she started training again last summer, with that Olympic dream still on her mind.
Coming back into the sport was a very big deal because I just actually hated gymnastics. So to find the love of it again is just amazing, and it's fun. Like, I feel like a kid again.
Her brother and mom weren't sure what to think when she floated the idea of a comeback. Here's Brenda Uselak.
We were like, all right, we're going to be the coaches. And if she gets hurt, it's all our fault.
Bodenschatz put in a lot of time conditioning. She appears really solid, especially on vault.
That looked better.
She's trying to get back and even upgrade the skills that earned her gold all those years ago.
I'm married and we have three amazing kids, and I'm at that point now that I'm like, wow, I miss doing stuff. I miss flipping. I miss doing this, and I can do it now.
The sport has changed a lot with a new scoring system and athletes like Simone Biles throwing difficult skills no one attempted in the early 2000s.
I feel like back then you had to be lean and very artistic, and yes, you had to be powerful, but you really didn't have to be. Nowadays, it's all about power.
A big test for Bodenschatz came at her first meet earlier this year.
I was prepared, but just, I never got nervous at a meet ever in my life until this one.
She did well on vault, but fell twice on beam and didn't get the score she needs to qualify for the U.S. Classic this summer. It would be her first major national competition in 15 years and an important step on the road to Tokyo. She'll get another chance in June. If she doesn't make it, she's okay with that. Simply competing again is an accomplishment.
Doing those other things is just icing on the cake.
Donnie Uzlak says his sister is inspiring all the young gymnasts who see her practice.
The most important part for me about this whole experience is just to empower girls to never give up.
They're watching her believe in herself and find joy in this sport once again. Amy Sisk, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
WYP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out more about Lissy. Singing and playing music started at the age of 9 for Lissy in her hometown of Rock Island, Illinois. She began her musical career while attending college in Fort Collins, Colorado. In 2008, Lissy received a break and was asked by Lenny Kravitz to open up for him on his world tour. Later on in the year, a song she co-wrote with DJ Morgan Page reached number 4 on Billboard's Hot Dance Club Songs chart. Lissy has appeared on records with Snow Patrol, co-written songs with Ed Harcourt, and has covered artists from Kid Cudi to Fleetwood Mac. Lissy's third release in 2014, My Wild West, was an independent and self-funded effort. To hear full songs from all of our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to WYP.org/women.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Opening arguments are being presented today in the homicide trial of former East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rosfeld. He's charged with the fatal shooting last June of unarmed teenager Antoine Rose. We're going to find out what we should be looking for during the course of the trial. Joining us in studio is University of Pittsburgh Professor of Law and WESA's legal analyst, David Harris. Welcome as always, David.
Good to be with you, Kevin.
All right, David, let's start with one unusual aspect of this trial. The jury was selected from Dauphin County last week and brought to Pittsburgh. So was this a victory for the defense? And if so, how big of one?
Well, I think probably on net, it benefits the defense a little bit. The defense was concerned, of course, with the pretrial publicity that has been pretty much at saturation point since the unfortunate events last June involving Antoine Rose and Officer Rosfeld. So the defense really was concerned that many people would have heard these stories and perhaps even have made up their minds. So getting a jury from elsewhere, either by moving the trial or by bringing in a jury from somewhere else, was a motion they simply had to make. The judge, I think, saw this as something that was a real concern. And in order to preserve any verdict at the end from appeal, assuming that there is a guilty verdict, and I don't want to make that assumption,
right,
but if there is, there'll be an appeal, and the judge would not want the failure to change venue to be an appeal issue. He brings the jury in from another county. The racial demographics are fairly similar to our county. In fact, there are a slightly larger minority population. On the other hand, people in that county won't have had the saturation diet of news on the case.
Right.
So net-net, it's probably a little bit of a win for the defense.
All right. Through the years, there have been several cases of legal proceedings regarding police and civilian interactions, including the beating of high school student Jordan Miles. But is this case, Michael Rosfeld, charged with killing Antoine Rose, the most followed trial since maybe the 1995 death of motorist Johnny Gamage at the hands of multiple officers.
Well, if you look back, certainly to Johnny Gamage and also Jerry Jackson's case, the one in the Armstrong Tunnel, all of these are kind of landmarks in the local legal scene, depending on who you talk to. If you talk to people in Pittsburgh who are African-American, they remember all of these cases quite well. Jerry Jackson, Johnny Gamage, Jordan Miles, and now this one, Antoine Rose.
All right. Remind us, Jerry Jackson was in the Armstrong Tunnels.
Right. In the Armstrong Tunnels. And the police officer who killed him did so with some unauthorized hollow point bullets and testified that the car had turned around in that tunnel and was headed for him. That's why he did it. Now, if you've ever been in the Armstrong Tunnel, you know how unlikely that is. The case was basically dropped. And then only a few years later, when some new evidence was uncovered, did the district attorney bring charges against the police officers. That district attorney was then relatively new district attorney, Stephen Zappala, who is still the district attorney here in Allegheny County. Johnny Gamage's case was another flashpoint. And resulted in the creation of the Citizens Police Review Board.
Three officers were charged.
Three officers
in the death
charged.
Of Johnny
Gamage. Never a conviction.
We got two mistrials and a separate acquittal in for a third officer.
That's right. That's right. Nobody was ever convicted. In Jordan Miles' case, there was no criminal conviction. There were two civil trials, and that case sort of stands as one where nobody was satisfied in the end. Between then and now, you had the case of Leon Ford, the young man who was shot and paralyzed by a police officer after a traffic stop. When something went wrong, the car started to drive away, basically going unresolved, too, on the criminal side. And then here we are now. We end up with this trial. Antoine Rose dies at the hands of Officer Rosfeld. It's a question of whether he was armed or whether Officer Rosfeld had any reason to fear for his life or the life of others. And this will be another landmark on Pittsburgh's landscape. If you follow these things over the years, this is part of the sweep of the last few decades. None of these should be viewed in isolation.
There was actually a connection in this case and the case of the trial and the death of Johnny Gamage, and that is a defense attorney. Patrick Tomasi was the lead attorney for Lieutenant Milton Mulholland, who was charged in the death of Johnny Gamage, and he is the defense attorney for Michael Rosfeld.
That's right. Mr. Tomasi is a very experienced defense attorney. He not only does police cases, he does lots of different kinds of cases, and he has so far shown himself to be pretty dogged in this case.
What are the prosecutor and the defense attorney trying to establish right off the bat in their opening arguments?
In opening arguments, what you attempt to do is to tell the story from your point of view. You try to get the full story out to the jury so that they get a sense of what the narrative is. You're not allowed to argue inferences in your opening argument, only here's what the evidence will show. So the prosecutor will attempt to show that this shooting, how it happened, that it there's no good reason for it, and so forth. Mr. Tomasi, for the defense, he will attempt to show something very different, that there was reason for Officer Rosfeld to fear for his life or the life of others, and that's why he shot. Think about it as looking at the top of the jigsaw puzzle box before you start the puzzle, because the jury's going to hear the story through the witnesses in pieces. Mm-hmm. And so this gives the jury a chance to see the whole thing.
On the final day of jury selection last week, the defense attorney, Patrick Tomasi, asked the judge to only allow the jury to consider a first-degree criminal homicide charge. Smart move by the defense?
Well, it's a gamble. It may be a very good gamble for him, but it is a gamble.
But how often does a police officer not only get convicted, but convicted of first-degree murder?
Not very often at all, and that's why Mr. Tomasi is doing this. He knows that what he wants the jury to be forced to do is to say, is this first-degree intentional murder or nothing? He does not want to have them have available the choice of some kind of lower homicide compromise verdict. He wants to put all the chips out there on the table and say, look, it's either this or not guilty. That's why he doesn't want instructions on anything else.
As an attorney, as an observer, what else are you going to be looking for as this trial moves along?
I'll be looking for whether Officer Rossfeld testifies or not. Lawyers always want to hear from the defendant. They want to hear it from the defendant's mouth. But it's not always wise to put somebody on the stand, even somebody you know might be telling the truth. It could be a very good witness because an experienced prosecutor like Dan Fitzsimmons is going to be a very good cross-examiner, and he can do damage to the defendant if the defendant testifies. So what Mr. Tomasi's job is to figure out how to try the case, see if he can get all the evidence in, get the maximum impact for his client without putting Officer Rossfeld on the stand. He may still do that anyway. He may feel he has no other choice.
Again, the trial of former police officer Michael Rossfeld in the shooting death of Antoine Rose is beginning this morning. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin here with WESA's legal analyst David Harris. And of course, in addition to that, he is the host of the Criminal Injustice podcast. And David, a milestone, 100 episodes. Congratulations.
Well, thanks very much, Kevin. Criminal Injustice was born right here at WESA. That was where I began working with two producers here, Megan Harris, your own producer, and former WESA staffer Josh Rollerson, to take this from the stage of being an idea to being real. And I'm grateful for WESA support, and we are at 100 episodes beginning today, and in just 2 weeks, it'll be 3 years that we have been putting up episodes.
So what was your intent when you began this?
Well, what we were trying to do was to deepen the conversation around criminal justice issues. I'm a source for a lot of press people. I talk to them a lot. I think of that as part of my teaching package, my teaching obligations. I want people to have real information, but so often, not here, of course, but so often with other media, I would get the feeling that we were going about an inch deep. And I would often feel like, boy, I wish there was some place where these things could really be discussed, the possibilities for reform, what the law is really like, why a lawyer does the things that a lawyer does, whether a prosecutor or a defense lawyer. And I wanted the chance to go deep with somebody on some of these things because I felt I had some insights to contribute. And it hit me at some point saying, you know, I could do that. And podcasting was just coming to be a real thing. Of course, now it's kind of a juggernaut, starting with Serial and everything else. Right. It turned out to be a pretty good intuition that was needed, that people wanted that, and people have been following us now for quite some time.
So you hope that listeners would learn more than an inch deep, if you would. But what have you learned from the podcast series?
Oh, Kevin, so much, so much. This has been one of the great experiences of my professional life, to talk to people week after week, to put up conversations with people where I get to go for their ideas and get their thoughts out to others, ask them the questions that allow them to be expansive. We've talked to judges, prosecutors, defense lawyers, a lot of people in the system, police officers, police chiefs, to explain to people what it is that that these folks actually do, what the concerns are on their particular piece of the criminal justice system. And I have found myself much more deeply informed about so much more than I think I ever was. I've always enjoyed the academic life and position, but this has allowed me to touch the practical world in ways that have just been so broad and so interesting. I'm just really grateful I've had the chance.
Final quick question. What are some of the topics we can look forward to in the near future?
In the near future, we've got a couple of really interesting interviews coming up with Emily Bazelon, who is a well-known author. She's going to talk about her new book about prosecutors. We'll be speaking to Van Jones of CNN in the next few weeks about a series of documentaries he's doing for CNN on restorative justice. And there's just a whole host of other people out there. We've got people coming to us. It's a great time to be doing this podcast.
We'll look forward to them. David Harris is WESA's legal analyst, and he's the host of the Criminal Injustice podcast. David, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, Pittsburgh often makes lists of most livable cities, but an advocate for people with disabilities says Pittsburgh has a ways to go when it comes to accessibility. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Mick Stinelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.